Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, it is the V-Spot. It is Wednesday. I am talking to Peter Sanderson again. He appeared on the show about a month or two ago, and he was, he just had a wealth of knowledge. Peter, how are you doing?
I'm okay, apart from the fact that we're in the middle of this heat wave.
Yeah, I tell you, I don't know how before air conditioners and I was telling a friend, I don't know how between the before air conditioners and bikinis, people didn't go on mass killing sprees.
Well, yeah, I was just reading a friend on Facebook who said she was glad she didn't have air conditioning, and it's like, and she said, well, I've got overhead fans, I've got great cross ventilation, but nonetheless, by last night, she was around midnight, she was complaining bitterly about how hot it was in her apartment. It used to be, of course, at this time of year, I'd go out to the San Diego Con, which would be an escape from New York summer weather. But I'm not going this year.
Yeah, it's like, so when you would do stuff like that, because I was curious about something I wanted to ask you about recently. I bought a back issue of Amazing Heroes. I mentioned this to you on Facebook, and it was an article about Squadron Supreme.
Yes.
That you wrote. And I was curious, were you ever on Marvel's full-time staff, or were you always a freelancer?
Oh, I've been on Marvel's full-time staff a couple of times. I was an assistant editor once, working in the X-Men department. So I was assistant editor on X-Men and New Mutants and also Star Wars and a couple others like books like Star Ears, which nobody really remembers. And I also came back at one point and I was the first and only staff archivist at Marvel, which meant that Mark Gruenwald put me in the Marvel library and I was in charge of making sure keeping the books in order, the bound volumes of old comics, but also doing research for people. If a reporter called up and wanted to talk about Marvel history, they'd have me talk to them about it. I'd even get to look over issues of comics before they went to press to make sure there wasn't some sort of horrible continuity error that got past the editors. So I've had two stints being on staff at Marvel. The rest of the time, it was freelance.
Okay. I was curious when you were writing the article, how much info did you actually have on Squadron Supreme series when you were doing that article?
Oh, well, this is a long time ago, but I would assume that at that point, if this would have been a preview of Squadron Supreme, so I probably had at least seen the first issue. Because certainly I was working at Marvel at freelance at that point. And if I've got freelance in 86, yeah. And I was friends with Mark Gruenwald, and I'm sure I would have seen the first issue at that point, at least. And so that was a bit of a controversial piece for Amazing Heroes because it's one of the things that Mark told me before we did the interview was that he didn't want to answer questions about, which is sort of the elephant in the room, which is that the Squadron Supreme started out when Roy Thomas co-created them as a parody of the Justice League. And I think for legal reasons at that point, they couldn't have Marvel staffers could not, you know, say on the record that the Squadron Supreme is based on the Justice League. So we couldn't actually address that in the interview.
Because I found that interesting when I was reading the article.
But I mean, it is sort of blindingly obvious, and I really didn't understand quite why there was some reaction to the Amazing Heroes article. Well, why didn't you bring up the point that it's based on the Justice League? And I said, because it's so obvious. Who doesn't know this? Another aspect of that article, too, was that at the point at which the interview ran, you know, this is 1986, which is that magical year in comic books. I'm currently working on a book about the comics that came out in 1986, and that was also the year of Watchmen. And early on in 1986, there was people who actually thought that Squadron Supreme and Watchmen were going to be similar projects because they were both seemed to be these sort of deconstructions of superheroes. Now, in fact, they're very different. But they, and I think by the time you get to the end of each series, you're well aware that they're very different. Alan Moore and Mark Gruenwald had very different visions of the superhero genre. Nonetheless, they both love classic DC superheroes, and it's and I think it is interesting that in that year you had these series at both Marvel and DC that which were taking this sort of deconstructive, slight, somewhat subversive look at what the superhero genre had classically been and raise questions about it.
You know, the thing, and Squadron Supreme is like one of my favorite comic series ever. I mean, because Mark Gruenwald is one of my, he's probably my favorite writer, like as far as the writing goes, he's one of my heroes. And the thing with Squadron Supreme that I loved is it did ask questions of him, but it still had the heart of a superhero book.
Yes, it did. I mean, really, even Alan Moore with Watchmen, he and Dave Gibbons have said in interviews that they weren't trying to you know, like sabotage the superhero genre because they love superhero comics. Mark was he was loving that, but I think Squadron Supreme, what Mark was doing was he was taking the classic Gardner Fox, Julie Schwartz Justice League, which he loved, and he was saying what would happen if it was in the Marvel Universe, and what would happen if you took the superhero idea of, you know, taking charge to save humanity. What if you took it far enough a certain direction? Because Squadron Supreme was really about the road to hell being paved with good intentions, that the Squadron members are trying their best to turn America into a utopia, but along the way they end up violating people's rights. They become in effect a dictatorship, however well-intended, that has to be overthrown. And that's one of the differences, by the way, between Squadron and Watchmen, whereas Watchmen is about superheroes being hunted down by the government, being outlawed for the government. Squadron Supreme is about superheroes taking over the government.
Yeah, and then having
to be overthrown.
One of the things I really liked about the series was that, Mark Gruenwald, when he would write, he would never take a side. You know, he would, when reading it, you know, you understand exactly why the Squadron's doing what they do, and when you look at the first issue, you kind of see how they came to that decision. It isn't like, you know, they just did it willy-nilly.
Well, I'd modify that and say that I think by the end of the series, I think that you realize the series by the end is saying that, no, the Squadron shouldn't have been these sort of benevolent dictators, that was ultimately the wrong thing. I think the way I'd phrase it is that Mark shows you both sides. I mean, there are obvious villains in the series like Master Menace, but in terms of this, you know, the Squadron members, Hyperion and the rest, taking over, basically supplanting the government and taking over the country, and Nighthawk and his revolutionaries who are trying to overthrow the Squadron and restore freedom to the United States. Mark lets you see both points of views, and he shows you how people with good intentions, good hearts, could be on either side. And in fact, I mean, and the Squadron, I mean, they end up doing bad things, but they do a lot of good things too.
Right.
And there are people on both sides who are let's say complicated morality, and there are heroes on both sides who end up having to get their hands dirty morally to a certain extent in order to work towards what they see as a greater good. So it's not as complex morally as Watchmen, say, but it is really strong for Marvel Comics at that time. And I think that looking back, I may at some point be doing some sort of project about Mark, but and we'll let you know if and when this happens. But I think that if you look back at Mark's body of work, Squadron is his masterpiece.
Yeah,
he's an underrated writer to this time. I mean, it's to this point, it's like. a lot of his Captain America stuff has been reprinted, I think, in large part because of the Captain America movie. Even DP7, the first issues of DP7 have been reprinted in recent years. But, you know, like Quasar series was a very personal series for him, and that hasn't been reprinted. It's I think that there's been a lot of writers whose work has been reprinted in recent years at Marvel and DC, but there are others who are still sort of under the radar and haven't been sufficiently appreciated. I've said to many people that, you know, Steve Gerber, I think, passed away. Just if he had lived a little longer, there probably would have been some major rediscovery of his work. It's like,
yeah.
The mainstream media and academia have only recently, the 21st century, really started to pay attention to comic books. And I think you're going to have, it's going to be like film history studies. The more people look at comic books, the more that they research them, the more that they're going to find out about these wonderful works of the past, these authors, these writers and artists who deserve more attention.
Yeah, you brought up Steve Gerber, and just to mention this, you know, is that his series, his Full Killer series at Marvel, it was really under the radar. I discovered it a couple of years ago, and I found it to be just an amazing comic all around. And, you know, and Marvel's never reprinted this, even though they did trade the recent Full Killer series, the one from 1990-91 was never reprinted.
I don't know. Hopefully, eventually. Eventually it will be. Hopefully eventually everything will by important writers will be. Maybe they think there isn't that big a audience for Gerber's work. I mean, they have reprinted his Man Things and Howard the Duck, of course. But it's, well, for example, like Omega the Unknown was an undeservedly forgotten series until, who was it, Jonathan Lethem? Major novelist wanted to do his own version of Omega while Gerber was still alive, too. And then Marvel ended up reprinting the Gerber series, but it's like, you know, it's I'm just hoping that the more people take comics seriously, the more that they'll go back and they'll look at. Well, for example, Entertainment Weekly recently did an article about the best superhero series of all time, and one of the things they named was Don McGregor's Black Panther, and I thought, wow, somebody there knows this stuff. Because it's like the Black Panther, the Panther's Rage series has been called by some people one of the first graphic novels, even though it was printed, you know, in serial form. And as for Gerber, I think that Gerber himself recognized this, that he was sort of like doing Vertigo comics before Vertigo. There are some writers who were sort of ahead of their time.
Let me ask you, because you also brought Captain America, Mark Gruenwald's run on that, and mm-hmm. when you were doing the handbook and the Red Skull was in the Book of the Dead, did he have any idea that he was going to be bringing Skull back?
At that point, Mark he was editing Captain America, and J.M. DeMatteis was writing it, and they decided to kill the Red Skull off. I guess they thought, you know, old Nazi villain, he's outlived his usefulness. Well, you know, my feeling is that it's always a mistake to kill off these classic Stan Lee, Jack Kirby. You know, Stan didn't have a hand in creating the Red Skull, but you understand what I mean. These great characters created by the founding fathers of the business, the classic heroes and villains, and even supporting characters. And, you know, you keep getting, you know, these writers who decide and editors who basically they decide – I think they can't think of anything further to do with them. But there's so they kill them off, but there's always somebody else who's going to come along with these characters and figure out new ways to use them. The characters are that good. And when Mark wanted to kill off the Red Skull, a number of us, including me, were arguing with him. Because back then in the 80s, it was like the Book of the Dead, those characters were intended to stay dead permanently. It's like death was actually a real thing at Marvel and DC back then. You know, I'm not talking about, you know, your typical thing where, oh, there's a Dr. Doom story ends with this explosion and they never find the body. Oh, and well, of course, you know, he's going to come back. That's obvious. But you know, when Jim Starlin had Captain Marvel die of cancer, he was meant to stay dead. It's like Bucky was meant to stay dead forever. And Mark wanted the Red Skull to stay they did, and a number of us, including me, said, "No, no, the Red Skull is too good a character. You know, he's still got a lot of mileage left in him." And Mark finally came around and came up with a way to bring the Red Skull back in stories that he himself wrote. So, Mark, you know, it's sort of like a phase I think Mark went through. You may also recall that Mark was behind the character Scourge, the vigilante who went around, around killing off villains, but most of the characters he killed off were like these real losers like Turner D. Century, who it was hard to believe anybody would ever find anything new to do with them. So it's like, but nowadays, of course, death is meaningless in comics because, you know, they'll kill off major characters and one writer will do it and the next writer who comes on board will bring them back, or the same writer will bring them back, and it's actually made comics worse, because I think that if you can't take death seriously then in stories, then you're sort of forfeiting their reputation for any sort of realism. You know, mortality has got to be real, at least for some characters.
Right. And it's frustrating. I probably said this last time, you know, but a lot of times with the writers of these books, you know, if they, you know, when you kill off a character and you bring them back, it feels like that the writer is saying they don't care. And if they don't care, you can't reasonably expect a reader to go and pay $4 and have them care.
Well, that's it. It's like, it extends to, I don't know if we talked about this last time or not, but it is something I've talked about in the past with various people, but I think that there's sort of a, you know, it all goes back, I think, to the death of Superman, but, you know, everybody is, but, you know, that was all, they were always intended to bring Superman back. The thing is that now they're doing, people do it over and over and over and over and over, and there's enough readers who seem to fall for it each time. I mean, really, at this point, it's like even when like characters got killed off in Crisis on Infinite Earths, and DC said, no, the Barry Allen Flash, the original Supergirl, they will never, ever, ever come back. They come back. It's like, but now I think writers and editors do it cynically, like, you know, like the recent deaths of Captain America. Well, make a good storyline. But of course, we're not going to kill off Steve Rogers. We'll bring him back in a couple of years. And it's like, if they're getting this cynical about it, you know, it's like, again, I think that that's going to piss off a lot of readers. It certainly does me. And also, it means that, you know, by this point, any major change in a character's life, I realize, it's like you can see the puppeteers move and the strings on the, manipulating the strings on the puppets now. Any major change can be easily undone. Like a few years ago during Civil War, Peter Parker publicly reveals he's Peter Parker, right? And then, as part of the deal with the Mephisto, that gets undone, so everybody forgets he's Peter Parker. And the marriage to Mary Jane is undone. Or, you know, Superman recently with the reboot took it even further. You've got 20 years of Clark and Lois being married. Surprise, we've just rebooted it, and although that never happened. So why should any major change seem important in comics now when you know that, you know, it might not even last a year before they decide to undo it.
Right, and you know, and I think the difference between now and back in the days of the 60s, 70s, even the 80s and 90s to a degree, is when they would make a change to a character, they were kind of playing fair. They intended to stick with it.
Yeah.
So I think people were less reckless because they understood, you know, this is going to have consequences. This is going to be the new status quo. We're going to have to deal with it.
Well, for example, because I was just writing about this, an old article I did about the Dark Phoenix sagas being reprinted in Europe, and I did a new introduction for it. And so I've been thinking about this. Chris Claremont and John Byrne did not want to kill off Jean Grey when they did the Dark Phoenix saga. But Jim Shooter, who was editor-in-chief, said that, you know, he didn't buy Chris and John's argument that Jean Grey had gone insane as Dark Phoenix. And, you know, she couldn't really be held accountable for what she did while she was insane. He thought she either had to be like sent to prison forever or had to be killed off to expiate her guilt in for Dark Phoenix's crimes. But once Chris and John decided to kill Jean off, Chris intended Jean to stay dead. And he was not happy when years later it was decided when the original X Factor was started, oh, we'll bring Jean back by saying that Dark Phoenix wasn't Jean after all. Chris rightly was upset about that because it undercut his story, which by that time was regarded as a classic.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and just going by what was going on in the series at the time, it really did a number on Cyclops because, you know, I don't think Chris Claremont would have had Cyclops get married and have a baby if he thought that they were going to bring Jean back, because then he had to abandon his wife and kid.
Oh, you are exactly right, and Chris was also upset about that because with X-Factor having Scott go back to Jean, that was making Scott look really horrible for abandoning his wife and son. So, Chris objected to that at the time, too, but he was overruled. But I'll give you another example. I mean, for example, when Peter Parker and Mary Jane got married, or when Clark Kent and Lois Lane got married in the comics, it's like these were big deals, and they got a lot of publicity. If major characters get married in the future, who's going to care? Because we've already seen the Peter Parker and Clark Kent weddings get undone.
Yeah,
of the marriages being big deals was because you thought it was a permanent change in the character's continuity.
Yeah, at this point, I think weddings at this point are devalued as much in comics as they are in real life.
Well, less so, because you can't reboot history, so your wedding never happened.
Right. One of the things I wanted to ask about also was... were you working on the handbooks when they did the loose leaf versions?
Yes.
Okay, how did that decision come about to do that?
The decision was that it was decided that the more recent versions of the handbooks had not sold as well as they could have, so Mark decided to try a different format and see if that would sell better.
Okay, was it now, because these versions, because I found one at the convention I went to a couple of months ago, one of the essentials for it, was it more difficult having to find the parts in the character's biography that was essential to the character?
With the loose leaves, in one way it was easier because you weren't doing these long text histories of the characters. On the other hand, it was... In a way, it was harder because you now had this bibliography section where you had to name the important issues in the character's past. And this was, of course, before the Internet, before the Grand Comics database, when it was not all that easy to research old issues of comics. So that was a little bit more difficult. I think another reason for the loose leaf format was that there was a certain point of view, I think, that, people don't really want to read these long histories of comic book characters. But I think that Marvel and DC have always sort of underestimated readers' interest in comics history in reading this sort of thing. Because it's like, you know, like the later version, the more recent versions of the handbooks, and again, Marvel now seems to have stopped publishing handbooks, but the more recent versions of the handbooks have gone back to the long history formats. As I've said before, I think that things like Wikipedia articles about comic book characters are the descendants of the sort of thing that I was writing for the Marvel Universe handbook and Who's Who.
Definitely. No, I remember when I was and I'll tell you, the companies don't seem to realize this, and I don't think I'm alone in this. When I was a kid, to me, the fun part about when I first started reading comics was all the history I didn't know. I had to dig through, and when I was like 12, I didn't know there was two different Human Torches.
Right.
You know, and there was just like these different things you discover, and it's like a big mystery, and you're just uncovering it step by step. And you know, I kind of miss those days. You know, when I didn't seem to have know a little bit of everything about the history.
Well, there you are. And it's like, I think that, I mean, though there's always been a point of view at the companies, as long as I can remember, that, you know, the young readers know they don't care about the old stuff. And meanwhile, of course, they're turning out reprint collections, and they'll do things like, say, Infinite Crisis and Identity Crisis and Final Crisis at DC, which all sort of depend on Crisis on Infinite Earths, which is now over 25 years old, being something that current readers would know about. It's like, you know, people know more about history than they think. But yeah, it's like this was, well, for example, I think that, and again, this is something I've said to people before, that I think that a model of how to do a long-running series is what the BBC has been doing with Doctor Who. They did not reboot it when they brought it back. They keep the continuity intact, and now they make the new episodes easy enough for new viewers to follow, so you don't have to know the 50-year history. But when they decide to bring a character back from the past, that's when they tell you. I mean, for example, the first season of the new Doctor Who, they didn't bother to tell you about the Doctor regenerating until he actually had to do it at the end of the season. But I think new viewers, the kids who have started watching the show, they're probably delighted to find out about this stuff from the past. And also this way,
yeah,
the BBC can market the old videos and of the old series. And again, people are discovering this for the first time. And in England, parents watch Doctor Who with their children because it's like they're not shutting the older viewers out. They're saying that stuff all still happened. That's all still part of the continuity. And the BBC, of course, this year is making a huge deal over the 50-year anniversary, where people have pointed out that DC and Time Warner seem to be of two minds about. They're not as doing anywhere near the amount of publicity for Superman 75th that you'd think. You know, there is going to be like a Superman 75th anniversary panel in San Diego, but, you know, they're not doing when Superman turned 50, you know, they had a Time magazine cover. There was a TV special about it. It's like,
but you're right about Doctor Who, because my nephews, you know, they're 9 and 4, and the 9-year-old especially loves Doctor Who, and he loves the fact that he can go back and watch these old episodes.
Yeah.
You know, because it's so much available, and another thing.
And so you watch, the new episodes, and you see Daleks and Cybermen, or you see characters from the past like Sarah Jane, and then you find out, oh, gosh, I can actually go look at these videos and see their previous adventures. There's more that I can find out about it. If you're a fan, this is a wonderful thing.
Yeah, and another thing is, you know, in the digital age we live in, you have so many means to access old issues of stuff. And I mean,
yes,
whether you use legal means or the not so legal means, but the point is, these are all available at a finger's touch. Or you can go to Amazon and buy essentials.
You can buy essentials, you can get digital copies off Comixology, or what a huge change. I mean, not only has so much stuff been reprinted, Mark Evanier has pointed out that he thinks virtually everything Jack Kirby ever did in comics has been put back in print over the last decade or so. But it's but also, you now have libraries that collect graphic novels and comics collections. And, you know, I've been to... tried various libraries over the last several years, and, you know, not every library does that good a job at choosing what to collect. But I spent a lot of time at the Columbia University Library, which has a superb graphic novel collection. And I'm reading all sorts of things that I haven't read in years, or that I'd always wanted to read, but I don't have to, as an alumnus, I don't have to spend money to read them. And it's like, all this stuff is now, you know, if you look hard enough, a lot of this, so much stuff is now available. And if you say that, you know, if you're a fan of, say, Spider-Man, you really want to know about the history of the character, well, it's easy now for you to go back and look at the Lee and Ditko issues or the Lee and Romita issues. Or, you know, and anybody who's writing these characters now, you know, it's easy enough to find previous writers and artists' work on these characters and to compare and contrast. And the older stuff being available, the best of the older stuff sets standards that the new people should be trying to match.
Right. Another thing I wanted to ask you was during the Atlantis Attacks crossover, you did a few stories in the backup editions of the annuals.
I did a whole series of stories about the history of the Serpent Crown that were in all the Atlantis Attacks annuals. So there were maybe a dozen of them.
Yeah, I thought you did a very good job. One of the Roxanne characters on the committee, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, but you did a very good. I thought you did a very good job giving him a lot of personality. And I was wondering, have you ever wanted to write something fictional?
No, as I keep telling people, there's a certain mindset among comics writers and comics fans that anybody can write comics. And no, it's like being able to play the piano. Some people have the genes in them that'll give them musical ability. Some people don't. Some people can be writers of fiction. Other people can't. I'm not a writer of fiction. I mean, I was able to do the Serpent Crown series because basically what I was doing was I was retelling old stories and filling in gaps between them. For example, I did when I got to the Squadron Supreme segments, I was sort of Steve Englehart had already given me a setup with his Avengers stories about the Squadron and the Serpent Crown, and I was sort of showing what was happening behind the scenes in that story. You know, what was happening with Squadron members that Steve wasn't showing in the Avengers, and so it's. But that's not the same as coming up with a brand new original story. I'm a critic and a historian. I write about comics, I write analyses of comics, I write histories of comics, but I don't see myself as a fiction writer. However, I mean, if opportunities arose to do something else similar to the Serpent Crown saga that was sort of oriented towards history and filling in gaps, that's something I could do, and I had fun doing that, and I actually did fill in some interesting gaps. Like, I'm just thinking about how I did the Serpent Crown that I came up with this story about the Black Knight of King Arthur's time having this fight with Tyrannus, who is the Hulk's villain, who's this immortal Roman emperor. And I thought, it's sort of like they're around it. Rome fell the same century that King Arthur's Camelot existed. Nobody's ever done this before. Why not bring these two characters together? And one of my rules, by the way, was that anything that was in the original story was gospel, so that, you know, I didn't think of myself, for example, as a better writer than Roy Thomas. So if I quoted from a scene that Roy Thomas had done, I'd use his dialogue. But if I was doing felt free to invent dialogue or actions that happened, say, in between panels of the original story, whereas nowadays writers feel like they can just, you know, overthrow past stories and do their own versions that handle the material differently, and, you know, they don't really care about, like, Stan's dialogue. If they do a flashback to what happened back then, they'll come up with their own dialogue, and I don't believe in that. I've always believed in respecting the past work, especially when those people are, you know, like leading writers in the comic book business.
When you did the X-Men Encyclopedia, because I was looking up some of your past work, how much work did that take?
The X-Men Ultimate Guides?
Yeah.
I don't think it was all that hard because I pretty much knew all that stuff. Doing the later editions, there were three editions I worked on in total, and doing the later editions meant keeping up with what had been going on recently, and by the time the third edition had rolled around, you know, it had been a long time since I'd been on the Marvel Free Comics list, and so that took a certain amount of research to try to catch up with this stuff. And again, this is before libraries were really collecting comics, or before, like Marvel's online unlimited service, where you pay them something like $9 a month, and you can get access digitally to all these comics online. So it was much harder to research back then. And but now, of course, I have. If somebody would hire me to do new books about what's been happening with Marvel or even the X-Men specifically, it'd be easy to do research. It'd take a while to read a whole lot of stuff, but this is what I do actually every week. Every week I spend a day at the Columbia University's library in the graphic novel section, reading stuff that I haven't read before, and you know, keeping up with what's going on. I don't want to be one of these old timers whose taste sort of freezes and who doesn't read new stuff anymore. I'm a comics historian and critic. I believe it's important for me to keep up with what's happening.
Yeah, that was one of the things I've noticed.
Even if I don't like it.
Yeah, since I've been following you, I've been impressed with how much you keep up with current comics. Because again, some of the older writers, you know, they seem to kind of fall out with the current scene. What I'm wondering is, with all the comics you've read, because you mentioned on the last show that you read everything in the DC library, has there ever been a series of comics that you had a difficult time making it through because you just didn't like them you didn't think it was very good or it was difficult to read?
Well, obviously there are bad comics. What comes to mind, first of all, with regard to DC is that the golden age of comics in the 40s, most of that stuff was really bad. I mean, it was written for kids. The art was often crude. And, you know, there are things that are like Will Eisner's The Spirit, you know, was done in the 40s. And that, of course, is not only one of the greatest comic books, albeit done for newspapers, of all time, but it holds up beautifully over the years. There are artists back then like Lou Fine's work on Black Condor and the Ray, which is still very striking. The stuff that there's, you know, like stories that Bill Finger and Dick Sprang did on Batman. There's sort of classic Captain Marvel stories. There's stuff that's charming or still holds up, but most of it is really bad. Really mediocre by today's standards, and so sometimes that was sort of hard to get through. More recent stuff. Well, I mean, there's always good stuff and there's bad, and there's periods in long running series that are better than others, and you know, obviously, I'm going to prefer like the John Broome, Gardner Fox, Carmine Infantino Flash of the 60s to, say, the Flash of the 70s. But I'd say, you know, it's like, but no, it wasn't doing all that reading in the Marvel and DC libraries. It wasn't really that painful at any times. And the stuff I'm reading at the Columbia Library now, sometimes I'll take a look at a series and I'll be delighted and surprised. Like, I really love Bill Willingham's Fables. In other cases, I'll look at a series that I've heard about and I'll, like, read the first volume of, like, Grant Morrison's The Invisibles and say, oh, okay, so that's what it's about, but I'm not really that impressed and I think it's overrated and I don't really feel like this urge to read volume two, well, you know, not for a while anyway. So, you know, it's not that things are painful to get through. It's like some things interest me more than others. Some things I like better than others. But I make a point of trying to sample as much as I can. Like when Comixology recently offered like over 700 free digital first issues from Marvel, most of which had come out from the last 10 years, I downloaded them all and I've been moving my way through. And there's an awful lot of modern material from various companies that, you know, I just think is dreadful. But if I sample it, I decide, okay, I'll go no further with it. Other times I make discoveries and I think, oh, gosh, this is nice. I really like the Batman 66 comic that DC is now doing, for example. And the same guy who writes that has been writing things like Agents of Atlas for Marvel, which I discovered to my discovered that I liked, and so now I'm following his work, and it's I've even friended him on Facebook. So it's like, there's Theodore Sturgeon's law, that the science fiction writer, that 90% of everything is bad, but you look for that 10% that's worth it.
One thing I was curious about is when the handbooks were being done in the 80s for Marvel, how much of the Marvel Golden Age material for Captain America and Namor and the original Human Torch, how much was that considered canon?
I believe that, and here I think I'm quoting Roy Thomas, I think that the Golden Age stuff and the stuff from the 50s was not necessarily considered canon, but that Roy especially would adapt, if it was adapted into a modern story by Stan or by Roy or by somebody else, then the new adapted version would become canon, okay? So that, take the Captain America stories of the 50s. Those were, Steve Englehart was the one who brought those, brought back the 1950s Cap, but he established that the 1950s Cap was not the original. Well, actually, that's a good example, because when Stan and Jack brought Captain America back, they had him going to suspended animation at the end of World War II. But there had been Captain America stories published in the late 40s and the mid-50s. And so obviously those could not be canon, at least not without changes. And Roy Thomas was the main, and Steve Englehart sort of revisited those late 40s and 50s stories and established that there were other heroes who had taken on the persona, the identity of Captain America, and that those stories from the late 40s and the 50s were about those guys, right?
Right.
It was sort of like, and Roy did like the Invaders series, and he co-created the Liberty Legion, and he was bringing in a lot of stuff from the Golden Age. But again, the way that he adapted it was what became canon. And in recent years, to my surprise, especially around Marvel's 70th anniversary, they brought in a whole lot more of the Golden Age characters, ones I'd never heard of. Like, what's his name? The Phantom Detective, for example? In the 12 series. And that's wonderful as far as I'm concerned. Or even like with Agents of Atlas, and these are characters from the 50s for the most part. They've made a few tweaks, like Yellow Claw was not really a villain, much less the racist caricature that he had been presented as. Venus was not really a goddess, but they've been brought in, and I'm glad I like that. I like being tying a lot of the timely stuff into the present. But again, it's sort of like Marvel is sort of like making changes here and there in order to, when they bring these characters into the present. Now, as far as at DC, until Crisis on Infinite Earths, I think that basically the 40s stories were regarded as canonical. And, Roy Thomas, for example, in All-Star Squadron showed them a lot of respect.
All right, we're about to be cut off in about a minute or two. One thing I was going to mention, Jeff Parker's the one that wrote the Agents of Atlas series, isn't he?
Yes. And he's the one who's doing Batman 66.
Right. The thing I liked about him, and again, I really, because I was expecting to hate this, because I really liked Marvel Boy. I liked the times he'd shown up in the Grunewald stories, but the difference between him and some people is you can tell Jeff Parker's very careful about what he keeps and what he gets rid of.
Right.
It's like a surgeon.
That's the way to do it. That's, I have people who respect the past, like him or like Roy, I have a lot of respect for them. Value history, don't just change it, and especially in an era now when, even stuff that they do like a year or two ago, it's like Geoff Johns did an definitive new origin for Superman, and then a year later Grant Morrison reboots it. I mean, come on now.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it feels reckless. I always call it, you know, a drunk on payday.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but of course, if we're going to be cut off in an hour, keep in mind that I'm always happy to talk to you. And it's, you know, whenever you want to do this again, just let me know.
Okay. Thank you for talking to me. Next week, we'll be having Jerry Conway on to discuss some of his
great
work.